Community needs to be commended because we measured our waste in just numbers of yards, cubic yards. Whereas cubic yard, well, you might put 10 to 20 cubic yards in one of those packer trucks that just runs up and down your street, and that's what we used to generate every 6 months. So as a community, we are pretty conscientious, but we also have the luxury of very inexpensive human labor to sort through our solid waste. Now, here's where things get a little stickier. Because we can't afford to have that landfill up there anymore, what are we going to do with our waste that is neither burnable or recyclable? We're going to export it. We're going to send it down the hill, put it on a barge, take it over to Chelan, and it may go to the landfill in Wenatchee, or it may go somewhere else. But we are, in some sense, placing our problem onto somebody else. Again, we had high-minded goals, but now we're falling into the trap of, well, what else can we do? Part of the what else we could do, if we really wanted to think about it, is to spend the money to build a state-of-the-art landfill up here. And it would be very, very expensive, probably $500,000 at least, if not $1 million or more, to put our teeny little 10, 20, 30 yards a year of waste in it. And this is where one of the points I'm trying to make is we have high-minded goals, but somehow between our lack of time, knowledge, or lack of money, we tend to fall short. Okay, now, let me back into something that's maybe more uncomfortable now that I question our greenness here at Holden. Let me question about whether, do we really think we have environmental problems? Do we really think the earth or God needs us to protect it? Somebody brought up the point of preservation of species. As a species, the human race, or in, I guess I'm thinking more of, since we've had written history of some sort, I'm not talking about Australopithecus or some quasi-human that the Leakeys discovered in Africa, but more modern people, if you will, since quasi-recorded history, if you will. We've only been around 10 or 20,000 years. In some sense, it seems a little bit presumptuous that we think of ourselves as a species being able to help or contribute positively when other species have been around for literally millions of years. And so I ask the question, does the Earth really need us to protect it? Even maybe a more disturbing question is, what if deep down inside our motivation is not to protect the Earth, per se, the environment, everything that isn't us as human beings? What if our motivation is really deep down inside just to save our own little hides? When we think about it, the kinds of disasters, and certainly this is not to minimize the kinds of things that we've done. We've certainly destroyed enough streams, killed off enough fish runs, turned fertile ground into deserts through irrigation, things like that. But in the really big picture, do we really think that we might be so big and bad that we might destroy much of God's creation? In some sense, that seems presumptuous to me. Let me ask sort of what people think about that.
Geologic history, the human species could disappear, and 10,000 years from now, you might have a hard time knowing it ever existed.
Okay, so we, barring nuclear disaster, maybe all some of these other things we're worried about might not be as wide reaching.
Some other species might damage the environment to the extent that it would kill other species.
Okay.
In the human absence.
Sure.
Yeah. I think one other thing is the greenhouse effect. Having listened to Charles Lane the last few weeks, we are now, for the first time in 160,000 years of recorded history, outside the envelope of CO2 that the Earth has stayed in. Since 1958, where it's been between 160 whatever. Were you at any of those, Carol?
No,
it was really interesting because for the ice in Antarctica tells us that throughout 160,000 years, the carbon dioxide levels have been within a range of about 170 something, and 260, and starting in 1958, we have gone exponentially up, and we're now 370. So we're like 50% over what the Earth has ever experienced in that whole ice history. So I think, and what could happen from that would be a Venus-like atmosphere. And so that, you know, they don't know, but the thing that makes us say this isn't something that goes up and down is that in 160,000 years, we are out of the envelope of the normal ranges of ups and downs by at least 50%.
Okay, so now here's a phenomenon then where we're a little more concerned because of the major effects. I'm tempted to say, bring up the example of dinosaurs, and isn't that an ironic term? We use the term dinosaur to describe an animal which was ill-adapted and unable to survive, and yet individual species of dinosaurs were around for millions of years, and here we are talking about, gee, we're outside the envelope for first time in 160,000 years. but that's a point well taken.
And that is mostly all the effect of human intervention, because it's the displacement of carbon within plant material through burning,
the population is.
And the population. And so it's, you know, that is human intervention. That isn't the natural processes of a planet or a variety of species.
Somebody mentioned population, which is one of the things I was going to get to. It's a polite paraphrase of a wise saying. As long as sex is more popular than dying, we're always going to have a population problem. And I guess that is a problem. If there were only five of us roaming around, it wouldn't make any difference. If there were only 5 million of us spread across the globe, wouldn't be too bad. It's when we're into the billions of people that we do have a problem. What do people think about that? That's a tough choice. That makes it a lot harder to achieve environmental goals if, in fact, what that somehow means is potentially population control. What do people think about that?
Well, you're going to pass the middle part of your diagram there, the government. There'll be too many other people saying, no way, you can't tell me how many babies I can make. I don't know. Going back to the first part of your discussion, it sounds like a lot of the problems that we're causing, I'm not sure if we're addressing them because it's bad for the Earth or because it's bad for us. You know, is it deep down inside our own selfish little need to perpetuate our own species that we want to deal with things like acid rain or the greenhouse effect or whatever? So, that's probably, you know, population control, and I think that's all imperative, you know, kind of one of those reptile brain parts that just says, you know, procreate and then you can relax and you can do whatever the heck you want because your genes have been dispersed. So.
Not because it's so much fun, huh?
No, I'm just wired into the reptile.
I have a comment about population growth.
Sure.
A lot of the developed countries, U.S., some of the European countries, they actually have zero, very low, or even some of them have negative population growth without immigration. And yet it's those countries that are producing the environmental problems, I mean, for the most part, that are causing the issue of population to be a problem. So it's like as the less developed worlds or less developed countries develop, maybe their population growth will subside. And I think the question then is, how can they develop to that point without harming the environment more and go through the development process that the other countries have already gone through without, you know, hopefully learning from the process that we went through to not make the same mistake.
Okay, so we have one of the ironies is that while the U.S. And other first world countries has a lower population growth rate, we're producing disproportionately the amount of pollution. In fact, almost to a higher power because of our lifestyle. And then this poses a very thorny question of what do we do with what's fair and just for developing nations. Should they get their turn in the driver's seat? Should they get their turn in the first world seat in terms of should they be allowed to consume as profligately as we have? Because my sense is that people around the world want to live like Americans. I'd like to live like a rich American too. What do we think about that? What's fair and what's just and what's realistic? Comments?
I question whether anybody wants to live like Americans. I can only speak for one little corner of one little country, but in our experience in Mexico, there is no envy of the American lifestyle, almost the complete opposite. You know, seeing this as wasteful and consuming. Lost our values.
Okay. Is that other people's experience?
Kind of a mixture, I would say. We have an abundance of resources, and we have an African woman who lives with us, and she enjoys, you know, some American things, but she's pretty vocal in, thinking how much we've given up compared to her culture.
Okay. I guess my sense of why, my perception that other people in other countries want to live like Americans is their willingness to buy American things as soon as we can export fast food or running shoes or things or maybe not exactly the staff of life kinds of items. I think that's a real interesting fine point that Carolyn brings up. Do they want our things, but they don't want our lifestyle? And in fact, maybe that points out the question. Do we have a lifestyle, per se, or is it just collecting things?
The problem of brain drain brings most of the third world into the United States for education, and people find a lifestyle and a community that supports the education and kind of the level of culture they get accustomed to in university. And the attraction to go back to India or mainland China or South America isn't enough. They forsake their country to stay. In fact, there's more Indian, this is a great statistic, there are more Indian psychiatrists in the United States than there are psychiatrists practicing in India. And that debilitates any effort for a third world country to try to adapt to gain from the resources of the developed world. In a sense, it's something to make it too attractive. We seduce them to stay.
But historically, that's always been true, isn't it? China was the place where the educated people went 700 years ago, or to Italy, or to France, or to Spain, not because of the resources they had, but because of the power and the economic trade that they had in sight. And I think we're seeing that now in Japan, and we've seen that in Hong Kong, which I think made it in Singapore, where people from the region or now globally will go to those communities because of the resources and power that is there.
The problem of brain drain centers on those people who've been sponsored by their governments to come and learn in institutions in America or Western Europe and then bring that information back and share it, and they don't.
I'm wondering if that is true. I'd like to know the statistics for the last 5 to 10 years versus 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, my sense is that it has, but
yeah, because I have the feeling I hear much more being appalled at what American life is like, the disparity, the violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's less of a draw than there
is. The dissent that I've heard from people at school is the opposition to the United States is towards the political. They enjoy the economic life that they have access to, but the political reality of America is something that they have a very hard time with.
Well, how can we draw back from the brain drain and the seductiveness of the American lifestyle back to the issue of environmental problems? let's talk about what maybe causes problems. I think standing in line at the picnic here, watch people, watch human behavior. I think one of the most fundamental drives is self-interest, and I need to have plenty on my plate and forget about all those folks that are way back in the line. And yet, that's here at Holden. Again, how we take care of our environment right here. Look at the litter that's out there. Again, because of time or lack of knowledge or just not being interested enough to take care of our own, cleaning up after ourselves. It's easy to see how that would magnify itself in a general population. One of the fundamental principles of ecology is the tragedy of the commons. If we all own it, none of us takes care of it. I think another cause of our environmental problems is the difficulty of understanding all the relationships that go into any particular ecological problem. For example, in the Northwest, we've been blessed by cheap hydropower, somewhat at a cost of controlling rivers, cutting stream flow, which means reducing salmon runs and infringing, say, on native fishing rights and that sort of thing. I suspect the day will come that we'll have to trade between higher electricity prices, which of course impact poor people more than it does the wealthy, to trade that against preserving the salmon runs, for example. But all these relationships are very complex, as Anne brought out about the global warming and carbon dioxide, and other people have talked about ozone. We're looking at just little brief moments in time, and we have a very difficult time looking over geologic time. We're dealing with very thorny problems. Our knowledge is incomplete, and even if we had near perfect knowledge, our political and social motivation might work negatively or counterproductively. So do we have any kind of consensus? Do we have environmental problems? Or is that just part of life?
I'd like to go back to your very beginning when you were talking about the expense of picking things up.
Sure.
What would you do if you didn't pick it up? I mean, it seems to me that we've got just so much land developed landfill. And what's a better option? To me, we do have environmental problems.
Okay.
Garbage.
Okay, let's deal with the environmental problem of solid waste. And the question was, what would we do? Are we running out of landfill space? And how else would we collect what we have now? I think one of the fundamental things we have to do is ask ourselves, is there another way to recycle other than just retrieve the material value? In other words, when we take an old plastic soda pop bottle, it basically becomes one of three things now commercially. Either it's ground up and it becomes the fuzz on tennis balls. Obviously, that's a fairly limited market, or it gets shredded and becomes the stuffing in fiber-filled jackets, or it's the polymers reused to make more soda pop bottles. The one other thing, because it's a very unpopular concept now, that we can reclaim from that material, of course, is not its material value, but its energy value. Waste to energy or incineration, that's a very bad word in a lot of places. If we were to instead recover the energy value, if the Gulf War had turned out differently, for example, we might be very interested in capturing the energy value in our waste, in which case we could all put it back in the same truck that we used to do 5 or 10 years ago, the same single truck that came down the street. If you're going to burn it, it really doesn't matter how you collect it so much. That's a possibility. One of the myths I'd like to dispel is that we don't have enough landfill space. That's just not true. Geologically, it's a politically created shortage, and it's one of the more unfortunate pieces of misinformation that's been foisted on the American public, because it triggers a lot of other things. If we assume we don't have enough landfill space, then we say, well, we have to keep things out of landfill, which means we should, quote unquote, recycle them, which means we should put them, collect them separately, and then try to do things with them. There are some very subtle economic effects that are occurring, one of which is the cost of it. Most people don't recognize what's happened to the cost of a waste disposal now. Your municipality might tell you, well, it costs more to landfill your waste, which is true, but I'm willing to bet that most of the increase in your garbage bill is due to hauling that second truck driving around and picking up your recyclables. The economic impacts are much stronger on poor inner city families who, you know, if you're flipping burgers for $5 an hour and your garbage bill goes up $5 or $10 a month, that's a chunk of your income for the luxury of recycling 50 cents or dollars worth of materials. There is plenty of space for landfills in this country. We have lots of areas of this country which have low rainfall. We choose areas with low rainfall because the less water that gets on the waste, the less leachate that's formed, and the less leachate, of course, which is a nasty soup, if you will, of the things that come out of garbage, the less of that we have to take care of and treat. So that is that should not be our primary motivation for recycling. Our motivation for recycling should be to save, for example, save energy in making new products. It does, in fact, take less energy to make new aluminum cans from old aluminum cans, to make new glass from old glass. But there, depending on the economics, the terrain, the markets, all these things, it's hard to tell whether in any particular instance it's going to make any economic sense. And that's, again, one of these problems here and why it's so hard to attain these environmental goals.
Orange juice in a plastic container, a paper carton, and an aluminum can, and the plastic container was the cheapest. That's unfortunate because it's the, in my mind, most expensive to recycle and to reuse. But it's economically cheaper to make the plastic container than the other two. So if we just banned all plastic food containers and forced people to use metal, glass, or paper, would that solve the problem?
These trade one material for the other question are always really difficult to answer. Plastic is expensive to recycle now, partly because of they're the lowest density. Which is in a lot of cases an advantage, because remember, a 1 gallon jug of orange juice in a glass bottle weighs less than a 1 gallon jug of orange juice that's plastic. And so you use less fuel to haul it someplace. This is what makes it so difficult, is you would have to look at everything from generation through final disposal or reuse, and you would have to know what it was going to be used for to make that determination. One of the things I'm kind of getting around to eventually in my own philosophy is that I think we spend a lot of time and energy worrying about what I would say are the smaller problems of making those kinds of choices. And we're missing out on the bigger, higher good kinds of things. Again, getting back to is it worthwhile saving a tree here in the United States while 10 people have starved to death in Ethiopia in the meantime, because we could have taken that, you know, money that we saved the tree with and somehow helped them to raise crops there or something. It's a very thorny question, and unfortunately I don't have any good answers for any of this. My goal is to make people pause, and my hope for people at Holden is that we take ourselves a little less seriously, not because there are or aren't environmental problems, but it's very easy to get wrapped up in putting that piece of paper in the right bin or the glass in another bin, that sort of thing, and to forget the bigger picture. But there's no direct correlation with saving the world or the world environment or the world's people either. That's what's disconcerting about having suggested this topic and giving this talk, is I don't have any conclusion. There's not really a closure to it. It's more of a, now that I've tweaked you, what can I do with you? Yeah.
There was, and I didn't hear the whole speech, and I can't remember who it was, but on NPR there was sort of an interesting noontime lecture by someone who was talking about recycling and alternative fuels and some of these things as a means by which communities could assume more localized control. And I kind of kicked off on the plastic thing, because I think one of the things that really pushes the idea of plastic is cheaper to ship long distances. So it makes it easy because it's lighter, you know. So the big companies, I'm sure, want to put things in plastic because it's cheaper for them to do all that transport. What this man was talking about the greater good, he was talking about that if you had a one big oil, gasoline plant for the tri-state area of the upper Midwest versus the ethanol plants, where there would be one in every two or three communities, what you end up doing is using local resources, creating local jobs, giving local control, local power. And he said the same thing was true of recycling, that if you could get to the point that there were friendly technologies where things could be reused and done right there. And he saw some of these alternatives as real ways to empower more regional and local areas to become a little more self-sufficient again. And that would also get around some of what you're talking about for you know, the cost of hauling a lot of this stuff around, that if you could get to the point there would be more plants, you know, to recycle newsprint rather than great big huge ones, but having smaller ones more frequently, and yeah, that there might be some real, and I think we have to maybe get beyond the cost effectiveness of it too, because I think you're raising the question about more money spent hauling that recycling stuff away. My thought is we have to get to the point where creating jobs for people is more important from the social good than the most cost-effective way to do things. And if you can create jobs for people or through recycling and through resource recovery, I think that that's a higher good than the most cost-effective way to handle garbage, you know. So that's another thing I would say about.
What do people think about Anne's point about making things more localized?
The good news is if individuals have to get involved or choose to get involved, it becomes their problem. And as long as it seems too big for me as an individual to do anything, then I feel powerless, and it's then nobody does anything in effect. Whereas if I'm choosing to be involved as an individual, then I may also involve myself with government and other groups to get the bigger goods served or the bigger jobs done, put it that way. But if the individuals don't feel responsible, say goodbye to the planet.
I think Anne's made a real important point, and Ron too, in that there's very much a strong trend, at least in the waste business, for that business to be dominated by some very, very large national / international firms. And that's not necessarily evil or bad, but you can see that local control is disappearing. And the flip side of it is who's willing to organize in their community or put the money forth to do something. And then I don't have any idea at all at how that fits into our global economy. Part of me says the United States should do what it does best, and if making inexpensive garments is not it, then they should let other people do that and do whatever it is we do best.
Who would that be?
That's a whole nother topic. One of the things that when we say we're recycling, for instance, mixed waste paper, essentially junk mail, most of that stuff goes overseas because though a lot of overseas countries, and particularly in the Far East, don't have enough pulpwood forests, or else they're conserving what they have, to make paper. And so they can afford to use this stuff and maybe make a lower grade of paper. For instance, to Southeast Asia, and they're hand sorted. And again, because they don't have the petroleum products and labor is cheap. So one way potentially of making recycling a lot more viable in this country is to lower everybody's wages. What a great idea, right?
But some of the environmental issues are local issues as opposed to the global issues also. And so there's kind of a mix here, it sounds like. I mean, I'm kind of curious from people from other parts of the country what the environmental concerns are where they live. I was surprised a couple of years ago. I lived here on the West Coast to go back to Chicago and see people commonly buying water at the grocery store. But why in the world would you do that? Maybe taste. Yeah, because I live in a community that's got wonderful water. They buy it at the grocery store. Or visiting Vienna last year, you pay for a shopping bag. If you go to the grocery store and you buy groceries, you have to pay for a shopping
sure.
bag. Everybody carries their own bags. I don't know if there's an environmental shortage of bags or what it is, but culturally, that's just the way it's done. In the San Juan Islands of Washington State, orcas, you know, are a big environmental concern, the whales. But who cares about that in Lincoln, Nebraska?
Right. So what are the concerns of other parts of the country?
Spotted owl.
In Washington.
Okay. Now, water in the Bay Area?
California. Okay.
Right. Let's talk about acid rain. What's the cause of acid rain in the Midwest?
Well, I think my understanding, because there's been a lot of international discussions there, my understanding is a lot of it really starts in the more eastern, like Detroit, that area. But then there's some also, there are some large Canadian plants too. But I think the biggest culprit is the big industrial regions of the Northeast or that are a little near.
Michigan, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
All the steel mills.
All those.
Okay, and the steel mills and the industrial areas are doing what to create acid rain?
Sulfur dioxide into the air.
Okay, so it's burning high sulfur coal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, there's a miracle low sulfur fuel. It's called solid waste. One of these major myths that's been imposed on the American public is that incineration is dirty. Historically, it hasn't been real clean, but if you go back, it hasn't really been any dirtier than burning coal, for instance, or things like that, or wood. I would contend that any new, as in the last 2 or 3 years, waste energy plant has probably got better air pollution control, more comprehensive air pollution control equipment on it than most any coal-fired plant. And one of the potential ways, if it weren't for the public image, it's the absolute terror about incineration, for instance, co-burning solid waste and coal in some form, would be a way to dilute the sulfur in the sense that you would have less coal to make the same amount of heat and electricity. But that's one of those solutions that's societally precluded, I'm guessing, till the mid-90s, when your choice is now oil, dirty coal, or solid waste. What choice might we make at that point?
Solid waste will make us all feel very ecologically proper, I think.
And maybe that's why we're burning solid waste to dilute on Lake Superior, because we probably are. There's lots of coal that comes through there. Pretty aware of the effects.
Well, one of the nice things about burning solid waste is that it takes away a major portion of a problem. It's burning a waste instead of a natural resource. Somebody mentioned water. Yeah, Carol?
You're talking about burning solid waste to produce something else, not just for the sake of burning it.
Oh, yes, to produce steam and then generally electricity.
Because in our town we have a relatively new solid waste, just strictly for the purpose of incinerating the waste. And there was a move to build another one, and the Willamette Valley being the fruit basket of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
Love Orchard is, Sperry Growers is still on 5 because of some whatever particulates are supposed to come out of it.
That's the one in Brooks that you're in Oregon? That's actually one of the better, although it's been around now for what, 5 or years or so, is actually, it was one of the first plants to have acid gas scrubbing in it. And again, one of the ironies is that the more our scientific knowledge advances, the more we can measure very small quantities of pollutants, and the more we get scared by them. And I'm not convinced that the pollutants haven't always been there, always as in recent history, last 10, 20 years, but now we're more aware of them, and they seem like important numbers on paper. And I'm not sure that the health risk studies that come out have actually shown that there's really any significant increase in, say, cancer deaths or other kinds of dangers from these plants. And we always have to remind ourselves, compared to what? Compared to a landfill that was the stuff in it was going to last 20 to 40 years before, now with state-of-the-art landfills, will last 50 to 100 years. What's the long-term liability for those things? And that's, we also have to ask ourselves, if we choose this solution, what other solutions are we bypassing? Or is this dangerous compared to what else? Let's talk about water for a second. Which is a higher need, clean water or clean garbage disposal? Is there any question? Well, but a more primary, you can, dirty water will kill you a lot cleaner than, quicker than piling your garbage on the ground. I sense that clean water is going to be one of our primary environmental problems in the next few years, because as population grows, as our industrial processes, we're creating more exotic materials and more exotic industrial processes. They all involve generally more, the use of more water. So I think the solid waste issues in the future will occupy less of our attention and less of our funding, and water cleanup will be more and more of an issue.
But one of the problems I think we've had historically is 100 years ago, the city of Seattle, the environmental people like yourself were saying, boy, what are we going to do about the horse manure problem in Seattle in 10 years? Because the city was growing like crazy, and they couldn't get enough hay, and they couldn't get rid of all the manure, and things were really going to be messed up. And the automobile came along, and there was no more problem. And those sort of quantum changes in our culture and our technology have kind of created an environment where a lot of us say, the scientists will solve the problem before it affects me. And so why do I need to worry about it? And I think a lot of us are still in that boat. You know, some environmental engineer will figure out a way to take care of all of our solid waste. So we don't need to deal with it now.
Do you think that's a pervasive attitude? That it's let the technical guys figure it out?
Yeah. I think a lot of people think these problems won't become critical till I'm dead, until after I'm gone. So I'm going to enjoy this life while I can, and why dampen it with these concerns?
Mm-hmm.
I think the attitude towards having children and the extended family, it's kind of diminished state in the United States, has eroded on the concern we have of our legacy. Comes out in that attitude.
And remember when I said at the beginning that environmental engineers basically do what governments and industry and society, by proxy, tell them to do? That we don't go out and just design things, well, one, because we're dependent on funding generally for government, because pollution control has in general always been the purvey of governments. For instance, there are very few private sewage treatment plants. One of the things we may see in the future is privately run water supply companies, which would be real interesting when that control goes over to the private sector rather than the public sector. I'm glad you brought up that point about technology, because part of me says that, yes, if society tells us to do this, we can figure out a better, cheaper, more elegant, whatever, way of doing things. And so technology does hold promise, and there are leaps in technology, computers, for instance, and those things will happen. On the other hand, it's really incumbent on society to say what's important. And if doing with slightly more environmental risk on one hand, in the sense of air pollution, means that everybody can afford electricity, then maybe that's a way we might make a decision. Again, the issues are never quite so clear, and that's why we have debates and that sort of thing. Closure. Do we know if we have environmental problems?
Sure we do.
Okay. And I think most of us would agree that there are a number of causes. One is because there are so many of us, or so many of us in a small area. Two, it's because to deal with and minimize those problems requires a lot of extra time, effort, and knowledge on each of our parts. And some of it, solving these problems, requires knowledge that we just don't have right now. We have to get into the middle and try 10 different things before we come up with anything that we're reasonably satisfied with. I guess my parting shot is that we would take ourselves a little less seriously when we come up with a solution, because my sense is that whatever we come up with today, 5 years from now, we're going to say, boy, what a dumb idea, we shouldn't have done that. And if we take ourselves too seriously, we're going to be pretty disappointed 5 years from now. And that, just to understand that that's just how things work as we move towards any goal, environmental goals in particular, is that we do it in fits and starts, and technology catches up, and then maybe society says, you know, this is great, but we can't afford it, and we retrench and start over again. So maybe if I leave you with the thought that don't accept everything I've said, don't accept everything that everybody else here at Holden has said about the environment, do continue to question and do make yourselves heard. I think the best thing each of us can do for the environment is get a 29-cent stamp and a piece of paper and an envelope and write to somebody, whether it's a manufacturer of a product that has gone to minimal packaging or a product that you think is superior and less harmful to the environment, or to a local official or a senator or congressman, to make your voice heard as to what you want to see done. Thanks for your time.
Sure, were you being facetious when you said $500,000 for a solid waste treatment center for Holden Village?
Oh, I'm...
Or did I hear you correctly?
Well, I did say $500,000. What we would have to do to make a landfill here is we probably wouldn't ever build it on top of the tailings, because the tailings is a long-term liability, because and it's Forest Service land as well. So we would have to find a piece of land that's big enough to do this on. We would have to excavate it, since there aren't any holes in the ground or gravel pits here now in the village. We would have to bring in, we would have to put a plastic, if you will, a polyethylene liner and a leachate collection system, and then another liner on top of that, to make the bottom part of the landfill. And then to cap it, we would have to put another plastic line over it and then put soil over the top. The problem is our volume of waste is barely bigger than this stone circle here every year. But to remember, everything would have to be barged in, hauled up the hill. You would have to have expert crews. You could not do it with volunteer staff to weld the plastic sheet together, all the piping. That leachate we collect would have to go to a kind of treatment plant that we certainly don't have here. I mean, we have pretty primitive sewage treatment here, and on and on and on. Maybe the $500,000 is wild, but I it would be very expensive to do here.
I would say that Ellen. The figure was probably not wrong, because in our little town, we are supposed to make a new thing so that the water would be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one company said that, well, they would do it for whatever, X number of dollars. I think it was like 600,000.
but they didn't guarantee it. And then the next one said, we will do it for $1 million+ and we'll guarantee that it works. We have the same thing that we have put 1.3 million and it doesn't work. Because the first company said, well, we should have done this instead of, well, we need to do this now. And so if we had done it from, but I don't know how the first one would, or the second one would have guaranteed it. But if they say $500,000 now, it probably is 750.
Costs tend to go up.
Are there high-tech and low-tech alternatives to similar problems? And is it, you know, where
two different solutions, one very computer intensive,
one that
the
requires
other
a lot of participation, and another that requires a professional?
Well, pick a problem and
solid waste. Could you have lots of small solid waste things that can put together?
Well, for instance, the way recycling, and most people think when they set out the curve, they've recycled. Of course, whatever you set out is not in what we call a market-ready form. And so let's just say you wanted to recover newspapers and aluminum cans and three colors of glass and pop bottles. Well, when people throw stuff out, there's always junk that gets in there, and that has to be sorted out before it goes to market. People say, well, this coffee cup's broken, I'll throw it in with a glass. Well, one little chip of ceramic can destroy a whole melt of glass because of the chemistry of it. And so somebody actually has to spend some time sorting glass, different colors, that sort of thing. And traditionally we've done it with people standing next to a conveyor belt and the materials come by them and they toss in different bins. And that does create jobs, but it's pretty menial labor. And the cost of collection really makes that expensive. We could go to higher tech systems, for instance, optical sorters for glass, which can tell the difference in colors. Mm-hmm. Those are brand new. There are probably only not even a half dozen places in this country that use them right now. Mm-hmm. There are other ways of collecting, for instance, it's being used in Chicago called the blue bag system, where you put all your recyclables in one bag. Oddly enough, we found out that you get less glass breakage when you mix plastic and cans together with glass than if you just put the glass in a separate container. Mm-hmm. One of the things is that sorters will not sort broken glass. They'll only pick up whole things, even though they wear gloves. So heretofore, if you're using manual labor to sort glass, you have to keep the glass unbroken. Therefore, we found out you basically need to sort it at the curb by color, and then you can allow it to break, or you have to keep the bottles whole. So the high-tech approach might be to commingle the recyclables in a blue bag, and you would put the paper products inside another bag in the blue bag, throw it in one side of the truck, and throw the other colored bags on the other side. It would go to a plant, they would pull out the blue bags and sort it just like you would normally do, but it would mean you would only have one truck going down the street.
What necessities are there for four different kinds of glass?
The different colors? Oh, that's my favorite harangue, those of you that have heard it. There's a foreign vintners and beer and breweries think that Americans think that imported beer is better, and one of the ways they think it's better is because it's in green glass. I don't think we brew very many or bottle very many beers in green glass here. Yeah, and Mickey's Big Mouth.
Yeah.
But and so what that means is we've got an oversupply of green cullet, broken green glass, because you can't use 100% of it to make a new glass bottle. In other words, if I break an old one, I can't make a new one out of it. I can only use 20-40% of the broken stuff in this new one. So we have a stockpile of green glass, and the company that recycles in Bellevue, Washington, said, we're the biggest market for it. We can't take any more. We just can't get rid of the stuff, and we don't have enough parking lot to put it on. So that's probably one of the biggest things people would say. Well, we used to buy your wine or your beer, but now we're not going to. I mean, give me Corona. It's in that
clear glass.
Yeah.
Clear glass that goes with Coke and goes with Miller, goes with everything else. You know, it's just take out these little bitty anomalies and things that won't go together.
And see, that would help us eliminate the green glass. I mean, somebody has said that it protects the beer and the wine from certain kinds of degradation, but I don't know.
I've only heard that of brown glass and drugs.
So I don't know, but that's one of those things I think we could get rid of. That to me, green glass seems like an extraneous packaging material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Thanks for coming.
Oh,
great. Let me give you mine.
Is this first setting?
Yeah.
Now tell me how to say your last name.
Is it the T repeat? Jim.
Correct.
Jim.
Okay. And all the heads in the room.
And yeah, and everybody in the room right now is a jammer. So.
Oh,
you're surrounded.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting when the guy was talking about the quantum leaps and technology, the legislation that's mandating that, 25% of all the cars in the LA have to be electric by the year 2005 or 2007 or something like that.
All the cars,
25% of the cars in LA have to be electric.
Well, did you read the article in a paper about 2.5-3 weeks ago about a new patent on a new electric engine for cars?
No.
That would allow you to go 300 to 600 miles between charges and have enough power to
compete on the freeway?
Well, to go from zero to whatever fast enough so that people would be willing. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's pretty big news.
Cool.
Well, that's unfortunate. We have to have real strong medicine, and you know, until price of gasoline goes up or environmental regulations, which are...
The thing I'm wondering is if it's legislated, everybody's going to assume that one of the other four people that he knows is going to pick up the electric car, not me.
I got a big kick out of the guy who talked about the Seattle manure problem, and then saying, then we had a car and I got rid of the problem.
Whoa.
We just transform it.
Didn't we, though?
Until we figure out how to solve the problems, whatever they are, we haven't figured out anything. We just change the form every once in a while.
Well, and that's why if you take it too seriously,
you get depressed.
Yeah.